Thank you very much. Great to be here. And that's an excellent introduction. I'm a little embarrassed to, not embarrassed to where I've come from, but you know, I just started wearing shoes a couple of years ago. So I'm from way out there. It is great to be back with this group. This is sort of old home week for me. I've had a marvelous, blessed, and charmed career and the opportunity to do tremendous things. But I've told many of you, one of the things that has been missing from my professional career is full-time teaching. That has never been a specific part. And I've taken students all along. I've taken family medicine residents. MU actually had a pilot program where they sent family medicine residents to my practice for their OB rotation. And they got quite a few more deliveries generally with us than they did sometimes when they did their rotations in Columbia. But I respect what you do. I envy in many ways what you do. And I appreciate so much the impact you have on students, on family medicine residents, through the advocacy work that you do, which I'm going to kind of expand on a little bit in terms of the topics and issues that face us in the field of medicine and in family medicine in particular. So thanks for what you do. Appreciate the time that you have spent here this week talking together about how you continue to do what you're doing even better for our patients, for the family medicine education system. I'm going to talk a little bit about the AMA because many people don't understand fully what the AMA is. I would call the AMA the convening organization for our profession. We bring together representatives from 190 state and specialty associations twice a year in our House of Delegates to debate issues. And those 190 represent physicians from every specialty, every geographic area, every practice model, be it solo independent, direct primary care physician, all the way up to large mega groups. There is no other organization that can do that for our profession. And as I talk about the advocacy issues today, and you already heard Bea talk about this a little bit, partnerships are critical. There is no one organization that can accomplish all we need to accomplish for physicians, students, residents, and our patients. We have to work together. We have to have multiple voices bringing different perspectives to the table and taking those perspectives to the state and national legislatures as we advocate together. And the successes come when we can speak with a unified voice on issues like medical student documentation. This is a quick shot of the AMA board, very diverse board, most diverse that I have experienced in my long history with the AMA. The AMA is the oldest and largest organization. I already referenced our House of Delegates. About 520 delegates, and maybe 530 now, and alternates. So over 1,000 physicians and students and residents come together to debate and discuss and adopt policy for the AMA, which then I take on the road. You may think this next comment is pandering, and you would be right. We have, so Dr. Odell mentioned the three past AMA presidents. Let me tell you how past family physicians who've been AMA presidents. Let me tell you how family medicine is represented on the board at the present time. Steve Permut is past chair of the board. I'm president. Jerry Harmon from South Carolina is chair of the board, so family medicine physicians have both the chair and the president simultaneously, the AMA. Good representation. Al Osbar from North Carolina practices mostly OCMED but has family medicine background, and Bill Kobler is from Rockford, Illinois. You have five family physicians, practicing family physicians, on the AMA board at the present time. I think that's impressive. And I will tell you that is in large measure due to the influence of the AAFP in the AMA House of Delegates. The AAFP gets its power at the AMA because of its AMA membership among family physicians who are also members of the AAFP. That determines their representation in the House of Delegates. AAFP's delegation, one of the largest in the AMA's House, and through collaboration with ACP, ACOG, often AAP, American Academy of Pediatrics, that primary care voice has substantially altered the policy base and the trajectory of the AMA. Strong voice. The other voices that impact us are the sections. There are a dozen special sections, including med student section, resident and fellow section, young physician section. I've highlighted the academic physician section there. You can see the others. Each of these was developed by the AMA so that these unique constituencies would have a greater opportunity to have a voice in the AMA House of Delegates deliberations, influence policy, and so forth. And I would suggest to you that this combination of special sections, along with especially the primary care base that I already mentioned, has had that substantial influence on the direction of the AMA. I think all of us understand we're living in times of unprecedented rate of change in healthcare, no matter which metric you use, whether it's clinical advancements, health information technology, payment reforms, workforce issues, physician employment. All of those are at unprecedented rate of change levels. What that means is things will look differently 2, 3, 5, and 10 years from now. And if we, as physicians, want that future to be the best future for physicians, our students, and our residents, and our patients, we have to engage and we have to shape those changes. That's what STFM is doing, that's what AAFP is doing, that's what AMA is doing. And again, to the extent that we can find those common areas and speak with one voice, we can be that positive change. This is the other line that I'd, one of the main things I'd like to get across to you. So my son graduated from osteopathic college a year ago. His dean was, at that time, president of the American Osteopathic Association, invited me to give the commencement address for the for Nathaniel's graduation a year ago. And I was reflecting on what I could say to that group of graduating osteopathic students that would make a difference, that would help them achieve the reason they went into medicine in the first place. And I think it's the reason that most of us went into medicine, and that is to make a difference. To make a difference in the lives of our patients, in the health of our patients, in our communities. And the way that we do that is by capitalizing on the fact that as physicians, we are leaders. We are de facto leaders. Our patients look to us for leadership. Our office staffs look to us for leadership. The nurses on the hospital floor look to us for leadership. Our students look to us for leadership. So it's not a question of whether or not as physicians, and particularly you in this room, are leaders. The question is what kind of leaders will we be? And that was a challenge that I put to those graduating osteopathic students. And it's a challenge that I think we should continue to put to ourselves. Are we making that positive impact that we have the opportunity to make on whatever situation we're in? And I hope that you charge your students and your residents with this challenge as well. Challenge them to be the leaders that we need them to be in advocacy, in healthcare, in education. AMA's advocacy efforts stem as much as anything from these principles in the AMA Code of Medical Ethics that call for respecting the dignity of all humans, compassion, respect, all of this stems from that. And I think you will see through the next few slides as I talk about our advocacy agenda how these principles come through and guide our advocacy work. We have, as you know, facing us in healthcare a myriad of issues, all very important issues, issues that impact how we deliver care and how our patients access care and receive care from the system. I'm certainly not going to talk about all of these today, but the point is it is a broad, broad palette. And again, and I'll say this maybe 2 or 3 more times, we all have to work together in one way or the other on whichever part of this advocacy palette resonates the most with you. We've got to roll up our sleeves and work together in order for the trajectory on any of these to go the right direction. 2017 was a big year for health system reform. All of you know the reasons why. The AMA advocated around longstanding AMA policy, the policy that drove us to support the Affordable Care Act in the first place back in 2009, 2010. And we advocated around these five principles and several others as well, but these were the big five. One was, we do not want to see the coverage gains that were made through the Affordable Care Act lost. That includes expansion of Medicaid, which we continue to favor. We had a little setback in this with regard to the essentially the repeal of the individual mandate in the Budget Act, remove the penalty for not purchasing credible insurance. That will probably result in about five or so, depending on whose numbers you believe, million more that will be uninsured as a result of the repeal of the individual mandate. So we will work to find a workaround for that. But maintain the coverage, maintain the safety net programs of Medicaid and CHIP. Those are critical. I think all of us would recognize and admit that Medicaid is probably underfunded already, and to cut out $800 billion from the Medicaid budget, which is what was proposed by various bills in Congress, would gut that program and would have substantial negative consequences for our patients and our communities. We need to preserve the patient protections, like can't be excluded from coverage based on pre-existing conditions. Stabilizing the individual insurance market is sort of code for trying to get more competition into the insurance exchange marketplaces. Over a third of the counties in this country, and almost all of the counties in Missouri, have only one offering in the exchange. And that is no choice for patients, it is no choice for physicians, and it is not the best way to operate an exchange. So we want to look for ways to get more competition back into the exchanges. The cost-sharing reductions, or CSRs, if you've heard about those, are one way to do that. Those are not bailouts for the insurance companies. Those are premium subsidies that the insurance companies adjudicate to help the insurance be more affordable for the individuals that are seeking to purchase through the exchanges. But it does take some of the risk off of the insurance companies. And then lastly, and I think all of you recognize this, insurance is still not affordable for many. Even with subsidies in the exchanges, particularly for moderate income individuals, the premiums are priced too high, and almost all of those products have a very high deductible that effectively is no insurance for basic care for many of the individuals that are covered. It's catastrophic care coverage perhaps, but it doesn't get them the direct access that they need. So these are some of the areas around which we advocated. Our tagline was patients before politics, and I've said already, partnerships are critical. Whoops. Oh, I don't know if I can go back or not. Can I go back? Red. The red one? There we go. Okay. We partnered with these other organizations very powerfully and very effectively. And I went around the country with representatives from some of these organizations, and we convened news conferences, and we bring in patients, and we let the patients speak about how it would impact them if some of these provisions that I've just mentioned in the Affordable Care Act were undone. And this was, I think, along with the advocacy of many, many other physician organizations, the proximate reason that we have been able to slow down any unraveling of the ACA at this point. There are many other things that although there was not a health care bill per se that passed Congress this year, there were tax bills and budget bills, several of which included some of the items you see on the screen here. A big one was repeal of the Independent Payment Advisory Board, or IPAB. That was a piece of the Affordable Care Act and would actually allow a fairly independent group to cut health care payments to providers if Medicare spending exceeded a certain threshold. It was bad to start with. CHIP has now been funded for 10 years. I think all of you know that. That came in two pieces through two different pieces of this legislation, but in fact we're covered through 2027. There are funds to fight the opioid epidemic and some others there that you see. Couple of other big wins for medicine and for our patients were blocking of the mega mergers between Anthem and Cigna and Aetna and Humana. That would have consolidated those big five insurance companies down to three. And if you think it's difficult to deal with the insurance companies now, imagine how it would be if there were only three mega insurers in this country. That was huge. You can see the statistics on the slide there. Physician payments alone from the Anthem-Cigna merger alone, not counting Humana and Aetna, would have reduced payment to physicians by $500 million and $2 billion total to the healthcare system when you throw in the hospital payments. So those are blocked now. However, there's a new potential threat on the horizon. Those were horizontal mergers between insurance companies. You are aware now of the proposed vertical mergers between pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, and others. Those potential impacts are unknown, is unprecedented, so we don't have any track record or history, but we, the AMA and AFP, are very concerned that those may have detrimental effects for both patients and physicians, so we're watching those closely. We were also successful in blocking payment reductions for services that are provided under a 25 modifier. That's if you do an E&M service and then you also take off a skin lesion, you put a 25 modifier on the E&M service. Aetna, Anthem was proposing to cut the reimbursement for the E&M service in that combination by 50%. And we and other organizations said, no, you can't do that. And so we fought them and they have backed off of that now. And in fact, those conversations have led to some collaborative conversations between the AMA, AHIP, American Health Insurance Plans, which is their trade association, and the Blues and a couple of other organizations to come to the table and talk about how we can reduce the burdens on physicians from the payers, both payment-related issues as well as prior authorization issues, tiered formularies, that sort of thing. So really excited about those efforts. I'm going to skip past that. Prior authorization is a huge burden for physicians. When the AMA and others do surveys about why the physician burnout issue is so bad, and I'm not going to talk about that anymore except to say it's horrible, over half of the physicians in this country and medical students and residents report elements of burnout. One of the top three is always the prior authorization burden. We do 37 prior authorizations in our offices each week on average. It takes 16 hours for either us or our staffs to process those. That is horrible. It delays care. Most of them get approved, but only after a lot of effort, and patient waits 2 weeks to get what they need. So we have put together a white paper, brought 17 organizations together, including the AAFP, put together this white paper that we have been pushing to the insurance companies, and lo and behold, it's working. In Washington State, Molina eliminated prior authorization requirements for 2,000 tests and treatments. That should make a big difference to physicians that practice in those areas. That's happening in New York and other states as well. And through this coalition that I was talking about, not the coalition really, the group that is going to discuss this, AMA, AHIP, and others, I think we're going to see some progress on this tremendous burden of prior authorization. Indeed. Been working hard on immigration issues, and I'll only go so far as to say we believe that international patients need to have access to the American healthcare system when they need some of the high-tech care that we get. We believe that international medical graduates need access to training programs, and our country definitely needs IMGs. 25% of all practicing physicians in this country right now are IMGs. And you know the statistics in graduate medical education, particularly in family medicine, critical to our part of our workforce issues. So we need to continue to work towards maintaining the DACA status for those individuals. Over 5,000 students and residents in the DACA status right now that could be potentially, in the worst case scenario, not allowed to stay in the United States. So this is a big darn deal. Gun violence in particular is a public health crisis. AMA has come out a couple of years ago with that statement. These are a couple of different pieces of our platform. We have 6 pages of policy on gun violence at the AMA, and after the big shootings that come up, I get to go out and advocate for the AMA's policy, most of which you can see here. And not the least of which two on that list are more research. There's been a moratorium on CDC-funded research. We got to have more research. We're evidence-based. We're scientists, and we need to know what works and what doesn't so that we can address this crisis. And then also the mental health issues. That kind of combined with the mental health issues around the opioid epidemic are critical for this country to get our arms around some of these issues. I'm going to talk for just a few minutes on medical student resident facing issues. We have a website called savegme.org. We've been working diligently, not entirely successfully, but diligently on expanding GME funding and GME spots in this country. I'll just stipulate right now, from the AMA's perspective, we can't advocate uniquely and specifically for expanding family medicine spots because we have other constituents in the AMA, but we recognize the importance of primary care. We recognize the impact, the positive impact that that has on the health of the population when we have more family physicians in the mix, and so to the extent that we can, we will push things that way. I think most of you are aware that there has been some funding that has come through the budget bill, the $15 million for rural residency programs that I think will begin to move the needle somewhat on our family physician shortage, and we still support the Resident Fellow Shortage Reduction Act. We have a lot of tools for medical students, so for those of you who have responsibility over students, I would encourage you to direct them to our website. Lots of information there, and I won't spend much time on it, but a tremendous resource for students. We're working diligently on reducing medical student debt burden. Now, we probably cannot have too much effect on the debt that they accumulate. I mean, we don't have much impact on the living expenses. We don't have much impact on medical school tuition. But we can work towards more scholarship-type programs so that maybe we'll reduce the amount of debt that some of them accumulate. We can certainly work on loan repayment programs, most of which will benefit primary care. And we're going to work on getting the interest rate for medical student debt lowered. The default rate for students is very, very low. The interest rate is not commensurate with that level of risk, so we need to get that down. All of you in this room recognize that debt produces a distorted perspective on specialty choice by many medical students. There are a lot more students that come into medical school saying, I want to be a primary care physician, I want to be a family doc, than come out the other end of the pipeline choosing that. And it is not just the academic environment that influences that, it is their debt burden to a large degree. So we've got to work on that if we want more family docs. We sponsor some global health challenges, and in time I won't spend much time on that. And the deadline for this particular initiative is pretty much not passed, but it's pretty darn close. But I just want you to know that global health initiatives are an important part of what we offer to students and residents, and I know that there is an increasing interest in that in many schools and residencies around the country. We'll shift gears a little bit and talk again about how the AMA has structured our strategic approach to this broad range of issues that I've been discussing. About 7 years ago now, the AMA board brought in a new CEO, Jim Madeira, academic by background, and asked him to take an all-up look at the AMA and say, what can we do with regard to organizing our activities that will make the greatest impact on patients and our profession over the next generation? And we cut out a lot of things that we thought didn't fit into those categories, and we've ended up with what we call our three strategic arcs. You can see them. I will touch on them very, very briefly. The top one is what I would consider the very physician-facing set of activities, tools for the field. I'll talk about that a little bit. Second is guiding professional development, and that includes our activities around Change Med Ed, includes GME, CME, maintenance of certification, ethical platforms, that sort of thing. And then the bottom tier on the slide is around chronic care. All of you know we spend $3 trillion in this country on health care, more than any other country in the world, on an absolute basis, on a per capita basis. Some estimates suggest that as much as 3/4 of that is spent on the care of chronic disease at one level or another, you know, including the downstream morbidity. If we're going to get our arms around the cost problem in this country, part of that, in addition to improving the health of the country, is getting our arms around the chronic disease problem. And so I'm going to talk about a couple of initiatives we started in that regard. So with respect to tools for the field, health information technology looms large. I think all of us understand the potential benefit of developments around HIT, both in terms of research, in terms of direct patient care, all the way from the EHR, the big behemoth, all the way down to mobile health apps that our patients are using in increasing numbers. It's kind of like the wild, wild west out there. There's very little regulation, there's very little standardization, and there's very little opportunity for either a physician or a patient to understand which apps or technologies are actually going to be legitimate and helpful. And how many times has some sort of wrinkle in technology come across your desk that somebody expected you to use, and you looked at it and you said, who in the world ever developed this? Must have been, you know, some high schooler who's never seen a patient. This is not going to work for me. It's not going to work for my patients. So these activities are just a sample of some of the initiatives the AMA has either started or are principals in that strive to insert the physician's perspective much earlier in the development process in HIT so that when products are developed, they come out the end of the pipeline, and they actually meet our needs and make our lives better and make care better for patients rather than dragging us down. I know many of you in here are researchers and all of you are clinicians. I think you would also agree with me that we have oceans of data about healthcare, but we have relative puddles of usable, actionable information, things that we can use at the bedside, at the point of care, things that researchers can use to advance the cause of healthcare. This initiative, the Integrated Health Model Initiative, is intended to bring together that information and begin to distill it down into more usable pieces and to capture missing data. Some of the comments Dr. Steiner made earlier regarding health equity or health disparities, however you'd like to look at it, we are missing a lot of data. I would challenge you I bet there's not more than 10 of you in this room who have an organized way to collect information about what food choices are available in an individual's community, what their personal goals are for their health care, about their background, their ethnicity, the racial disparities and impacts on their health. We don't capture that now in a very effective way. So this initiative is designed to bring all of that health information together, add what we don't have, and bring it to the bedside. Now, you may say, okay, Dave, that's great. That sounds like world peace to me, not happening. Good luck, you know, go do your thing. Let me show you some of the partners that are in this with us. This is a major, major initiative, and there's about 24 more that are in there. Everyone understands the importance of getting our arms around big health data, and I think that this initiative will begin to take us in that direction. I would also commend to you the Steps Forward modules. There's about 50 modules in Steps Forward. You don't have to be an AMA member to access it. In fact, you can have your office managers access these modules, and here's some example of what they are. They speak to everything from physician burnout, you can see on the right-hand side of that slide, several modules that relate to physician wellness and burnout. Many modules relate to efficiencies in the office, how you can just do a better job of writing your prescriptions, I mean, even down to that level of detail. Also, some change management modules. So I encourage you to consider utilizing these in your practices. Also would encourage you to consider joining one of the AMA communities. Right now there are 6. You can see them listed there. 2 of them are very directly relevant to academic physicians. The top middle is Succeeding in the Medical School Community. That is directly med student facing community, where the AMA often puts up topics to discuss and then the groups weigh in on those. You can lurk, you can post, you can do whatever you want to do in the community. And then you can see on the bottom right, that's the Accelerating Change in Med Ed community, and that's all the talk about Change Med Ed. And then you can see the others as well. For those of you who are researchers and are interested in HIT, I also commend to you the Physician Innovation Network, which is the bottom center community listed there. You go to the ama.org/communities, you'll see a screen like this. You click on whichever one you want, you look at it, and you go to the discussion boards, and I think you would find it very interesting. I've alluded to Change Med Ed. I know many of you in here are very familiar with it. Several schools in this room are in our consortium now, 32 schools. Over a fourth of all medical students in the country are represented by these schools. These schools were given grants by the AMA, some as long as 5 years ago, to come up with how to change medical education. I think all of us would stipulate that we do a pretty good job at keeping up on clinical advances in medicine. But if you think about the structural way that we educate students, we have been educating students structurally the same way in this country for 100 years. It's 2 years preclinical, 2 years clinical, off to residency. Same way, every school, except UMKC, 6-year program, there are a couple others around the country. But by and large, that's the model. It's undergraduate, then 2 plus 2, and off to residency. We don't do anything in this country like we did it 100 years ago. We probably should not be educating our students the same way. And there have been some progression in, you know, problem-based learning and that sort of thing. But in terms of adult learning and content and simulation, there's just so much we've got to do, including diversity and including what we call health system science. So you've got the basic sciences, you know, anatomy, physiology, biochemistry. You've got the clinical sciences, cardiology, endocrinology, dermatology. I think all of you would admit that unless you also have a rudimentary knowledge, at least, of the health system sciences, can no longer be successful in your own practices or for your patients. And so the AMA wrote this textbook. Many schools around the country are beginning to adopt it. Most are using it in the preclinical years, but some are using it later, to help introduce their students to these concepts and how important they are going forward. So I encourage you to consider that. I'm going to skip those. A couple of the schools in the consortium are working on the diversity issue. I just wanted to mention that in passing because that is going to be, it continues to be critical as we try to address the health disparities and health equity. We are going to pivot a little bit from the Change Med-Ed emphasis we've had in the last 5 or 6 years to Change GME. Don't know exactly what form that is going to take yet, but the Change Med-Ed initiative kind of has legs of its own now. It's kind of rolling and it will continue, but we're going to begin to change our focus to Change GME, and I am very much looking forward to that. Many of you in this room probably already use our competency-based education program. It used to be called Introduction to the Practice of Medicine. This is a number of modules that will help you in your residency programs comply with some of the ACGME related issues that are sometimes difficult for residency programs to pull together the resources to present to the residents. So if you don't know about this, I'd encourage you to look into that as well. I think it's a tremendous resource. And kind of lastly, I think I'm about done here. I am about done. Going to quit no matter what. Patient-facing issues. AMA looked at what we could do, and there are a lot of things we could have chosen. Some of you would say, well, it should have been obesity. Some should say, well, it should still be tobacco. Some should say it ought to be cancer. When we looked at where we could have the greatest impact on the trajectory of the health of the public over the next generation, we came down on diabetes and uncontrolled hypertension. One out of every three adults in this country has prediabetes. Many of them, not all, but many of them will progress on to full-blown type 2 diabetes. That process can be retarded or eliminated by proper interventions early on. And so we partnered with the American Diabetic Association, with the CDC, with the Ad Council, drafted this approach. It's called doihaveprediabetes.org and is designed to raise awareness among adults in the United States as to the risk of prediabetes. And so they go to this cutesy little website, doihaveprediabetes.org. You take a simple test, just a few questions. If you score 5 or more, you're referred to your physician for more definitive evaluation and then referral on to the diabetes prevention program if that is relevant. So we've had this website up for about 18 months. We've had Ad Council sponsored ads. We've had AMA pushing stuff. We've got 600,000 hits on this hokey little website over the last 18 months. Now that's a drop in the bucket to the number of adults out there with prediabetes, but that's 600,000 people that now know their risk and now can start doing something. Power of social media, sort of, if you will, or the healthcare apps, mobile health apps. We've been partnering with Samsung on a couple of items, and they decided to pick up the doihaveprediabetes.org sort of tag. They put a prediabetes screening tool on their health app. We got 550,000 hits in 6 weeks. So the same amount it took us 18 months to get on a website, even promoted by the Ad Council with TV ads and everything, it took 6 weeks to get that through a health app. So if you wonder where your patients are going for their health care information, take a hint. The other part is uncontrolled high blood pressure. Again, about 100 million adults have high blood pressure. With the new guidelines, about half of those are uncontrolled. With the old guidelines, about 30% were uncontrolled. And these are not street people. These are not indigents. These are not people that say, I don't know where I'm even supposed to go to get my high blood pressure checked. These are people that come to our offices, say they have a regular source of care. Yeah, I see Dr. Barb. And they're running around with systolics of 150, 160 or worse. That's low-hanging fruit. We can do better. So this initiative, in conjunction with the American Heart Association, and again, the Ad Council and CDC, Million Hearts, is designed to raise awareness among patients about the significance of uncontrolled high blood pressure and among us. We got to get a little more serious. We can't put it off. We can't say, okay, your blood pressure's a little high. Why don't you come back in 6 months and I'll check it again. So we got to do better. I won't spend any time talking about the opioid task force. You've probably been inundated with that, but we've made a lot of progress. Physicians are prescribing more than 20% fewer opioids than we did a few years ago. We're still prescribing almost three times as many as we did 20 years ago, but it's on the downward side. Deaths from prescription opioids also flat or maybe slightly decreasing. All the increase in deaths, as you know, are from heroin and fentanyl or carfentanil. Part of it is still work on our end. We still have to do a better job at managing pain without opiates. We still have to do a better job with our opioid-using patients. But the real key to this is going to be mental health and substance use disorder resources, which are sorely lacking in most communities. They are certainly lacking in rural southern Missouri. So a lot of our emphasis has been on expanding payment for treatment resources and expanding medication-assisted treatment. I was very gratified that many of you are teaching your students and residents mainly, to incorporate medication-assisted treatment into their practices. That is huge. That is a big, big deal, and I thank you for that. So, to end, I'll end where I started. This is partnerships. This is physicians being part of organizations that they feel are relevant to them. It's why you're in this room as members of STFM. It's why the vast majority of you are AAFP members. I hope that what I have told you today suggests that you have much in common with the AMA's initiatives as well. And in order for us to be the most impactful, for us to move medicine, all of our relevant professional organizations need to be strong and robust. They deserve our support. They deserve cross-collaboration. No one organization can do it. AMA can't do it. We have to have our federation partners. We need you as individuals or groups as members. So reflect on that. Reflect on the advocacy agenda. Reflect on the fact that not only are we leaders, but we need to cultivate that responsibility of leadership in your students and in your residents. So, thank you very much. Appreciate the invitation.